Go Loud. Go Loud presents Talking Bollocks, proudly supported by FlyFit. With 20 locations nationwide, there's always a FlyFit gym nearby to help you crush your fitness goals. Visit flyfit.ie.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in the snow. Tell your body a tent. Walk it hard and slow. When you finish that.
The hip knocker.
Go down, go down, go down.
Episode 191 of the Talking Bollocks podcast brought to you by Go Loud. I'm proudly supported by FlyFit with 20 locations nationwide and from €35 per month. Get onto flyfit.ie and get your membership now. It's me, COB.
It's me, Terry Flower.
And today we're joined by
Keith Duffy.
Brian McFadden.
With the lads, what? That's the most professional I've heard you since I met you 10 minutes ago. So you just...
There's a blind that goes down when you go live, you know what I mean? We're well trained.
We're like Anton Deck.
Yeah, Anton Deck.
Wait, start talking bollocks now, you know all about it.
Yeah, come here, he's living up to the bleeding, the rock star fucking lifestyle here. Keith has sunglasses on indoors. Yeah.
They're prescription.
I'm blind. I've got a glaucoma. I have to, these lights are too bright for me. Plus, I was up till 6 o'clock this morning.
Yeah. Cataracts, is it? That's what they call it.
Yeah, the cataracts.
Yeah,
how are you keeping, boys?
We're good. Yeah. We've got new music out. We just launched our world tour for next year. So it's, you know, we've spent the whole summer doing festivals in the UK and across Europe. And now, obviously, with the new music coming out, it's back doing interviews and stuff. And this is stuff that we don't normally do. You know, we just literally do gigs all the time. And then as soon as we have an album out, we're back talking. And it's different. It's a different vibe.
Yeah, you get out of practice. You know, we love what we do, but we usually play golf all afternoon, go on stage for a couple of hours at night, have a few pints and doing the same all over again. But today they have us doing interview after interview and it's, we think we're breaking up, are we?
Yeah. That's what I said this morning. I said, I might have to leave this band as well. It's wrecking me fucking head. You never thought it was going to be actual work.
It's have a world tour, you said there. Now.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, what's that like for you? I'm still announcing World Blade.
Well, it's exciting. You know what? This is the first time as well. We're doing America, which is the first time we've ever done America. When Westlife, we released music over there, but we never actually toured.
Right.
So this is the first time I've ever done a tour in America. So it's exciting playing LA, New York, and Florida, and
Cleveland,
all those places.
Indianapolis.
Vegas. So it's kind of weird as well. What, 30 years later, and we're still kind of doing new things, you know?
Yeah. We've never done a concert. We've a full live band behind us, and we do all the songs from Westlife and Boyzone. But we've written and recorded our own studio album as well, and we've just dropped a new song called I Would, which is getting great traction at the moment, which we're delighted about.
Mm.
But you know, to get the opportunity now at this stage of our lives to still have an audience that want to listen to us, you know, we just love what we do. We're very, very lucky. We're very blessed. We've never played in Ireland. Boyzone have never done a concert here, so we're very excited now with the new concert dates coming up next year. We're doing North, South, East and West. We're doing Belfast, Cork, Galway and Dublin. And then we move on to the UK, then the States, then New Zealand, Australia and up through Southeast Asia. So it'll be a busy year next year, but we're kicking it off in Ireland. So we're looking forward to seeing that. A lot of people haven't really understood what we do.
Yeah,
you know, including
ourselves. Well, we still don't know what we're fucking doing. But I'd be in Dimmy shopping in Tesco's and say, "Ah, Keith Duffy, what do you do now?" I'm 8 years on the road with him, but... We didn't work in Ireland.
The same. I went to get a smoke card and chips in the cozy the other day. Your man goes, "Are you still singing?"
Yeah. Singing for your supper.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Wouldn't be buying a smoke card if it wasn't, would he?
Yeah. Or we just getting a smoke card.
It's mad that you have to reach in and the bleeding, like in Asia and the Far East and stuff like that.
They were always huge countries for us. They loved the boy bands out there.
Madness.
In the 90s, we spent a lot of time out there, you know. And it was a real culture shock for two Northside dubs growing up in, you know, like in Dublin, and then all of a sudden you're out stuck in Asia for 6 or 8 weeks. It was different times,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is, and that was the thing as well. You know, when we brought out our and Boyzone would have been the same. We brought out our first music. You know, obviously you hear it on the radio in Ireland and you hear it in England, but then when you start getting phone calls going, your song is number one in New Zealand and Singapore and stuff, it's like, how?
Yeah.
Like, how do they even know about it? Like,
how do they even understand us?
Yeah. No, exactly. It's how. It was crap. I wouldn't buy it.
But it is crazy though, you know. And as you said as well, the places that don't even speak English, you know, like, and you go out there then and they're absolutely bonkers. Like the fans in Asia,
places where the first language is not even English, like Wales.
Yeah.
You go back to sleep.
Yeah. You two are liable to say something now to get us cancelled. So if you want to
we'll give it a go.
Can't cancel us. We're too old to get cancelled.
Right. Come on, which way are we going to deal with this? Are we just going to jump straight in?
Have we not started yet?
Yeah.
So what we do with all the guests is we go back to the start, but that's us 2 years. Right. We'll give a bit of a crash course then on each of you. So maybe how, where you're from, what was life like growing up, and how you got into music then. Keith, we start with you. Not because you're old, just go alphabet.
How did you know I was old? I look younger. I grew up in Donegal in Dublin, and growing up, my mum and dad worked very, very hard. We didn't have an awful lot, but we weren't short of anything either, you know. I loved playing Gaelic football and hurling for Trinity Gaels. And I started in a marching band as a drummer when I was very young. My dad was a great singer. Amateur, he was a tailor, but he used to MC the likes of the John Players Tops and the Gaiety, and he was in a couple of bands that did a lot of cover versions and stuff. In fact, in his later years, he went back into music. He had a great voice. Unfortunately, he must skip a generation, but he had a great voice, and I loved watching my dad singing. And I think watching him performing as a kid really made me want to be a performer. You know what I mean? My dad was a small man, but, you know, he had great range in his voice. And when he'd be singing, I used to look at the veins sticking out in his neck when he'd be hitting the high notes. And it used to just make me really proud, you know what I mean? Because you could see him giving it socks. And then, like, we go away as kids to Trebolgan on holidays down to Cork.
The business.
And my dad would always win the karaoke competition, you know. So he was a guitar player. He played piano. He played accordion. I was more into the percussion and the drums. And I got my first kit when I was about 13 or 14. And we'd a little shed down the end of the garden, and the kit was put into the shed. There was no room for anything else. I had to climb underneath the floor tom to get onto my seat, and I had a candle on the shelf here and a candle on the shelf there. There was no electricity. And I go down wearing 5 sweatshirts because it'd be Baltic, it'd be freezing. But by the time I'm 3 or 4 songs in on there bare-chested, and you get your rope, you're sweating, and a good workout. So look, I never wanted to be in a boy band. It wasn't my thing. I wanted to be a drummer in a rock band. Yeah. I wanted the whole sex, drugs and rock and roll. Not this squeaky image, you're not allowed to have a girlfriend boy
band.
You
got 2 out of 3, so it wasn't bad.
So yeah, look, you know, Boyzone came along and like I said, I came from very humble beginnings, and it was an opportunity to possibly go on an aeroplane, you know, to go to a different country. Before we be careful what you wish for. Before I knew what it was, we were flying all over the world, staying in 5-star hotels and just experiencing life. It was surreal, you know. And as quick as it happened, you kind of thought it could be taken away.
Yeah.
So you just live by the seat of your pants. It was like a white knuckle roller coaster ride, because you're just you have that kind of imposter syndrome where you just don't think you deserve it, or you don't think it's real, or it's going to be taken away from you.
Like easy come, easy go kind of thing.
Yeah. Now, obviously, at this stage now, 31 years later, we've earned our craft now.
Yeah.
We've practiced, we've got huge experience. We got the opportunity to perform with some amazing heroes of ours. Like, we performed with Pavarotti in Italy. We performed with B.B. King, Joe Cocker. Ricky Martin. The U2 lads had us in their Sweetest Thing video, and we brought Words by the Bee Gees to number one. That was our first number one in the UK. You know, and it's you forget about all that stuff, and I forgot about the Pavarotti thing. And it was just my kids now growing up and seeing things on YouTube that I'd forgotten. I don't even remember being there.
Yeah.
And there I am looking at a U2 video of me in some part of the world singing with some fame. I go, God, I don't even remember doing that. Now, that was probably down to the drink as well, to be honest. But sure.
I didn't want to say that. I mean, how did you get the call to be in Boyzone?
So I used to train in a place called Unique Physique in Moore Street, and Shane Lynch from Boyzone grew up beside me. We're both from Donegal together, and he's a couple of years younger than I am. And there was no sign of Boyzone, but we trained in the same gym. And this girl came into the gym one day and asked the two of us if we would do a male strip in a ladies' club in Clondalkin, you know. And like, money was hard to come by back then, and she offered us 50 punt for 15 minutes. So the two of us dived at the chance. I was working in Frawley's in Thomas Street at the time, because my dad was a manager up there. And myself and Shane knew each other, and we'd done that gig together. And we weren't great mates, we were chalk and cheese, but we knew each other all our lives. We grew up together, but we weren't best mates or anything like that. And I just saw him in the front of the Evening Herald one night with Colin Farrell. And they were the two first lads in what boy wasn't known as Boyzone at the time. The headline was The Irish Answer to Take That had started auditions. And I saw Shane, and I knew Shane, and I just thought, I met him in the gym, and I said to him, put us a word in there now, get me, I could do that. and he actually didn't. And it was bizarre, it was coincidental what happened. I was actually in the Pod nightclub dancing one Saturday night, and this guy came over. I was dancing on the speaker and he was pulling me trousers. Come here, I want to talk to you. And it turned out it was Louis Walsh. And he brought me into the VIP room of the pod and he said, would you like to be in?
What happened next? Didn't know that's how you got in the band.
I like your white 501s. Very nice.
White 501s.
Yeah, I like your white 501s. So yeah, he asked me, you know, could I sing? That I wanted? And I said, this isn't the band that's on the paper with Colin Farrell and Shane, because I knew Colin as well at the time.
Was Colin acting at the time?
No, he hadn't started. He hadn't done Benny Cassange at the time.
Right. So you just knew of him though, did you?
Yeah, we all kind of knew each other from town, from parties in town and stuff. So I ended up meeting Louis by coincidence. And the last audition was the following Wednesday night down at the Printworks. And I didn't go. And there was no mobile phones back then. And I wasn't staying at home. And my mum got in contact with me. She said, I've had a man on the phone called Louis. Well, she has to remember, nobody who knew who Louis was back then. He wasn't the TV star that he is today. And she said, he said that he wants to put you into a band and you never turned up. And I just said, no, I think I was kind of partying or doing something, whatever. But I went the following Thursday and that was the night we got put together. So I just went straight in at the last. It was only, I think there was a few hundred auditions, but it was down to the last 10 or 12. And I went straight in on the last and I was put into the band. And then Louis said to us, the first thing you're doing, you're on the Late Late Show tomorrow night. And that was that infamous clip on the Late Late Show when we jumped around like idiots.
Tell us about that, Keith.
You know, we were so young and innocent and naive. And like I said, you know, I wasn't in a position to ever have the money to go to university to get a third level education. I mean, I've been working since I'm 13, 14 years of age, selling, you know, vegetables and potatoes at the side of a road and trying to bring in extra cash to the house and stuff. So,
well, if you've heard our new album, we're still selling turnips.
You know, we just tried to support the family, help the family out. And this was, if this was to work, this was an opportunity to change my life, you know, and to support the family. And, you know, we all gave it a go, but we didn't really know what we were trying to succeed. We didn't know what success was. You know, we didn't know how do you know when you make it? Is it when you get a number one? Is it when you're on the cover of Smash Hits magazine? Is it when you're on top of the pops? You know, when you've the first million in the bank? When do you know if you've made it? When do you know you're successful? So everybody has different kind of, you know, goalposts, if you like. And it was surreal. After that Late Late Show, even though looking back on it now, it looked horrendous and Gabriel was so condescending to us, we all thought we were superstars the next day, you know? And we were in town and we were walking down Dawson Street going to Cafe Insane. And I'm saying to the boys, there's no way they're going to let us into Cafe Insane. And Ronan's dead straight. He's going, oh, we're getting in. And I was kind of falling to the back of the five because I wasn't too sure and I didn't want to get embarrassed, you know? And the bouncers just looked at us and laughed and said, and Ronan said, do you know who we are? And the bouncer said, if you don't know, how the fuck do I suppose to?
That's mad, because that's like us going into town now, isn't it, Terry? Yeah. It's nice to know that 30 years ago, they still weren't letting people in.
Yeah.
And that's it then, the rest is history.
Yeah, well then, no, you know what? It was very slow to start and we were playing, like Lou would get us dodgy gigs in the Limelight nightclub in the Glenties in Donegal and then we'd be down to Cork and then we'd be on the back of a 40-foot truck for the Rose of Tralee and it was very slow to get a record deal and a lady by the name of Margaret Hockley, I think her name was, she got us a gig on the Smash Hits Roadshow in the UK, which was a massive big tour of all the pop groups of the time around all
Michelle
the arenas.
Hockley.
Michelle Hockley. And, you know, R3 Arena here, there's arenas like that, obviously, all around the UK. And this tour was all these pop groups on the one bus. So E17, EYC, Bad Boys Inc., PGN Duncan, which you'd know as Ant and Dec. Those two girls, which is Denise Van Outen and another girl, Shampoo.
Peter Andre.
All these guys on the one bus. And they all were signed artists. We had no record deal. And we went on that tour. And there was three new acts on that tour. And we were only doing one song each. And there was big, big bins at the end of each arena. And on your seats where you went into the arena, there was three posters. There was a Boyzone poster, Juice poster, and Nick Howard poster. And they were the three new artists. And whoever your favourite was, you put it in the bin at the end of the arena. And at the end of that tour, there's the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party. And it's an award ceremony for pop music. And they get a big American artists over to perform and present it. Will Smith was hosting it that particular year. And we won the best new band on the road. So we got to perform Loving for a Reason on the Smash Hits Poll Winners Party, which went out live on the TV. And then that went to number two in the UK charts. And that's it. Then it just like roller coaster. Then we're like, and then you're in Germany for a week, and then you're Belgium, then you're Norway, like Holland. You know, all of a sudden 7 years is up and you're exhausted, you know?
Mm-hmm. So what ended up happening with Boyzone then?
Coming up to the end of 99, Ronan was the youngest out of all of us, and he lost his mother very tragically to cancer. It was a very short illness and it broke his heart. He was the youngest of five. And he just threw himself into work, which ultimately really didn't help him. And he was in a bad place. And he came to us, we were touring South America. And he said, I need some time off. I want to take a year off. I want to record music on my own. I want to do some solo stuff and stuff like that. Myself and Shane were happy to crack on. We had just been offered the biggest deal in America. Universal Records had just bought over Polygram Records, who we were signed to. And out of 400 acts, they were picking one act to be the priority act to be broken in America. So pumping the money into the act. You know, the Backstreet Boys had failed twice at this stage to break America. They were living in Germany at this stage. So Boyzone were going to be absolutely massive. The Spice Girls hadn't broke the States at this stage. It was a huge deal, but we'd already decided about a week or two previous that we were going to take a year off. But when we were in LA and we had a conference phone call from New York as the deal was going through from Universal to Polygram, and there was a speaker in the middle of the table and we're all sitting around listening to this guy going, guys, I got great news for you. You've been chosen as the priority act to be broken in America. And Ronan says, no, we can't do it. We've decided to take a year off. And I go, no, shut up. Just do this, you know. But ultimately, to be honest, we were shattered. And for us to take on that deal would have meant moving to the States without our families. I had a son at the time and we were very tired, you know. Mm. And sleep deprivation in that business, you can't enjoy it. Mm. You take it for granted. And it's not something that should be taken for granted. It's something that you should appreciate and enjoy. And when you start taking a great opportunity like that for granted, it means that you need to stop for a while.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's ultimately how Brian left Westlife, because he was absolutely knackered. He had two kids, you know, and you get to that stage, like there's a 6-year itch where you need a break. We were only supposed to break for a year, but that year turned into 7. Ronan went off and had a solo career. Stephen had a solo career, went into the West End. I went into Coronation Street. So we all went our different ways and it was impossible to get us back together. Mm. The BBC got us back together to do a medley of 3 of our songs for Children in Need, for a charity show in Children in Need. And we got into the studio to rehearse like a bit of choreography for the 3 songs. And we had a great time. We really enjoyed it. And our agent said, look, boys, the performance on Children in Need went down a storm. We just fancy getting back on the road and doing a tour. And we agreed and we had the best. 2008 was a phenomenal year because we'd grown up an awful lot. We'd matured an awful lot. We understood the buttons not to press with each other anymore, to bring the best side of each other out, to, you know, to understand each other. And 2008 was great. We got into the studio in 2009. We toured in the summer of 2009 and we were recording a new album, all new music. And unfortunately then in the October, we lost Stephen.
Yeah.
Stephen died in Mallorca and that just kind of, that killed us. We were very close and that was tough. That was a really, really tough time, you know. I don't suppose we really kind of ever came back after that. We toured again in 2011 without Stephen for the Brother album and it was a bad tour. We couldn't deal with being without Stephen.
Not the same.
No. And myself and Shane drank too much and we were just trying to dampen the upset, you know.
Yeah.
And then we came back in 2013 for the 20th anniversary tour, which was a much better time and we had a good tour. We enjoyed that. And then we left again and we came back in 2018 and we'd done a 25th anniversary tour when Brian and I were very, very busy at the time. We were doing Boys Life at that stage. So Brian came on the world tour with us and he was our support on the world tour with Boyzone's reunion. That was 2018 and 2019. And then obviously we had a 32-day tour around the UK and 5 nights into it, COVID kicked in and we were grounded then for 2 years. Mm. And we're that's us up to present day now, you know.
Yeah. What he said.
Yeah. Same for me, but Westlife, yeah, grand. Exactly. Yeah.
Roy, do you want to take us back to the start with you then?
As in like when did I start doing music?
No, bring, where are you from? What was life?
I'm from Artane. I went to Billy Barry's stage school when I was a kid, so that's where my kind of music interests. It was more musical theatre really when I was a kid.
Mm.
And then obviously, you know, Boyzone kind of opened the doors then in the mid-90s, you know, to actually be able to do pop music because it was unrealistic really to think of an Irish pop act. You know, you had U2 and you had all these different kind of rock bands like Cranberries, whatever. But there was no pop acts from Ireland. And whenever you think of a pop act like Michael Jackson or Take That, they were always, you know, they weren't Irish. You'd never think of them being from Ireland. You always thought they were from a different planet or something, you know. Yeah. So then Boyzone came out, all of a sudden there was this huge surge in Ireland of every bloke wanted to be in a boy band. It was like, well, if they can do it, we can do it, you know, let's try it. I don't mean it like that, as in if they can do it, we can do it, but you know what I mean? If they can break, you know, that there is an opportunity to actually, you know, have a career from doing it. So I started getting into it. I started a couple of boy bands and I was in a band called Cartel when I was about 16, 17.
Man,
and I
actually, man, boy band,
Cartel.
Out looking for money as well.
I think we went to the West Side, you know what I mean? But Yeah, so I actually got in contact with Louis Walsh to try and get Louis to manage Cartel. And Louis being Louis goes, no, I'm not interested. He goes, but I'll have a look at you for my other band, which was IOU, which was the original name of Westlife. Yeah, that's kind of how it went. And then obviously the Westlife thing was so quick and so big so quickly. You know, it was, you know, you hear Keith talking about Boyzone's, you know, beginning, where they used to have to go and play little clubs and, you know, start from the very beginning with no record. We literally signed on the spot with Simon Cowell, and our first show was supporting them in Wembley Arena with 15,000, 16,000 people. You know, so we went straight in, and it just went so quick. Our first single went to number one, our second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. We just kept having number one after number one. And
yeah, well,
we never
Hank Delay, I'm one of them.
I never even got a chance to take it all in until I left. You know, it wasn't until I left, and a few years later, I started to sit back, take a breath, and look at it all and go, that was fucking mad. You know,
did Louis just ring you and bring you down to the boys then?
He basically, yeah. Louis had five or six people that he kind of handpicked and brought down, and I was one of them, and Nicky was one of them. And actually, really what happened, there was a public audition on for, what was the guy's name that was running for a trad band? They wanted to do a trad boy band. So basically like a boy band version of The Chorus. So it'd be a boy band that sing, but they play instruments and fiddles and bowrons and all of that.
The High Kings.
Horrendous idea. No, not the High Kings. It was not worse than that. It was like, the High Kings are brilliant. It was like, basically, it was like a cross between Bewitched and The Chorus, but boys, you know, that kind. That's what they were trying to do, and it just didn't work. But anyway, they had a huge kind of a press launch, and, you know, the whole kind of country was turning up. There was blokes from Cork and Donegal and everywhere turning up to audition for this band. But what Louis did was Louis turned up and he watched it. And he was basically telling the guy he was going to help him pick the band. But all Louis did was went him, and then he took them for his own private audition. So he basically just took the best of that. So he didn't have to do his own auditions, basically. And that was it. And then we turned up the following week for this separate audition. And I actually got to know Nicky Bourne from the first audition. And I actually went out with Nicky on the night after the first audition. And we went down, we went to a karaoke bar. His dad at the time, God rest his soul, he used to do karaoke.
Race cars in Balahoy, was it?
No, in Gibneys.
Oh, really?
He was doing a karaoke night in Gibneys in Malahide. So I went out. I said, yeah, I'll come out and sang a few songs.
Brian loves the karaoke, don't you?
I love karaoke, it's the best. and then we had a chat about it, and I spoke to him on the phone then a couple of times, and then we turned up the next week, and there was about maybe 40 or 50 people at the audition, and I got up first because I knew that somebody basically told me that Louis Walsh had told one of the guys that you're definitely in, and I'm only doing this for the press. So I was like, I told Nicky this as well, and he goes like, you're joking. What a pain in the hole, like having to go and do all this. And at this audition, you had Louis Walsh and a few other people at a table, a bit like X Factor, that vibe. And then the lads from Westlife were all sitting up on the balcony watching. So you get up on stage first and you'd sing your song, and then you'd go up the stairs and you'd meet the lads, and then they'd sing with you, and you'd try and sing harmonies with them. So I got up first, and as I did my bit, I went up there, met the lads, and harmonies were my thing. So I pissed that, and I was like, I'll have these boys. They'll show them how to do harmonies. And I sang the harmonies. And then Nicky goes, well, I'll go next, because he wanted to get out as well. We just wanted to get it done and get out.
Get in and get out,
As far as we were concerned, we weren't getting it. So then Nicky went next. So I came down the stairs. Then Nicky went up. And as Nicky came down, there was a third guy on the stage singing. And basically, after he finished, before he even went up to the lads, basically this guy comes up, okay, guys, thanks a million. You can all go. We found our bloke. And I was like, wow, that's harsh. Didn't even let the rest of them sing. And then they started ushering everyone out. And this fella comes over and he says, can you stay? And says to Nicky, can you stay? And then your man that we knew was getting it is like, me, he's like, no, you're okay, you can go. And he's kind of getting ushered out the door, going, what's going on? And they basically closed the door behind him, and it was just me and Nicky standing there with the lads. And at that stage, there were six guys in Westlife originally, or IOU they were called. They all went to school together, they're all best mates. And when Louis signed them, he was just like, look, you're great, they're not great, and I want to get rid of these guys. So they got rid of one guy just straight away, he was gone. Then another guy, he was like the dancer in the band, and he used to do all the choreography for him, Graham. And he actually himself said, look, I'm going to step back. And he actually got the job as the tour manager. So he said, I'll stay on and be part of the management with Louis. Great. So then there was four of them. So they basically were down to me and Nicky. And, you know, instead of just picking the one he wanted, he was like, we'll have two. And he had all the press taking photographs and which one's going to get it. So then they sent us down to Sligo to live with the lads. So I think I stayed with Keane for a week, and Nicky stayed with Shane. And we rehearsed every day. But one of the guys, he didn't turn up for rehearsals. So every day they were kind of going through rehearsals with me and Nicky, trying to decide which one they were going to keep. And it kind of got to a stage after 4 or 5 days where they're just looking at each other going, this should be the band, like this should be the five. And in the end, they kicked the guy out and took both of us on. They're so proper rootless.
Handy.
Yeah. Do you know what though? It was horrendous as well. We were brought back up to the Pod nightclub and we were sat around in a circle and the tour manager took out a piece of paper and it was like a TV show and he goes, right, lads, it's that moment, the moment of truth. Who was in the band? And he said, just so everyone knows, nobody's safe. Right? Like this. And we're all like, what's going on? And he goes, the members of Westlife are. And he calls out and he goes, Shane Filan, Kian Egan, Brian McFadden, Nicky Byrne, and Mark Feeney. And everyone's looking at each other. And your man's just sitting there going, the guy that was in the band, he's like, what the fuck? That was it. And then literally, we just sat there in pure silence and the bloke just started to sob. And I was just sitting, it was so fucking awkward. I was like, this is horrendous.
But you said that and you literally just went straight into the deep end.
Straight in, straight on their tour.
What's that like for you then? Because like that's so quick, such a quick turnaround. Your whole life is at the change.
It was. It was very, very difficult as well because, you know, even though we'd done a couple of gigs, like showcases and stuff like that, they were in front of 100 people or something like that. And then all of a sudden you're going out and they're playing to 17, 18,000 people in some of these venues. And, you know, and I don't know if you've ever been to a boy band show back in the day, but like when a boy band walks out in an arena back then, it was a wall, it was like a this noise, and it, like you could feel it through your bones, couldn't you?
Yeah.
But I remember the first time
we walked out, brought our mas to the gigs.
Yeah. But that first time I felt that, we walked out on the stage and they just screamed. And I remember going, oh my God, it was like a drug. It was like you cannot explain to people what that feels like, that noise. And they don't do it anymore now, obviously, because they're all grown up. But that,
there was a guy like that that didn't get into Boyzone. His name was Colin Farrell. I'm sure he's sick.
Oh, yeah.
Brian, you left Westlife.
I did, yeah.
At the peak, though. Like, you literally got off at the top. How did that come about? Was it similar to what Ronan done with Keith?
Yeah, no. I didn't leave to do solo music, even though I did, you know, quite soon after I left. That was never my plan. As I said, we went straight into the deep end, you know, with the boys on tour. And then our first single came out, and it was literally just 24 hours a day. 365 days, how many days is it? 365? 365 days a year. And it was just constant. And I had two kids. And, you know, back then there was no FaceTime. There was, you know, there was none of that. It was like, if you were away, you just didn't see them. And I needed a bit of time off. I needed to just go home and have a life outside of it. Because there is no life outside of a band like Westlife or Boyzone. There is nothing else except that. Because it's such a massive, massive machine with record companies, managers, everything. And I just needed a break. And the only way I could get it was at the time by leaving. I did ask, you know, we did have conversations about taking time off, but nobody else wanted. It was the same as, you know, with Keith and Shane. Like, some people wanted it and some people didn't. So the boys did. They wanted to crack on and keep working. So the only thing I could do was leave, you know. And I don't regret it. You know, I look back now and if you took me back there today, obviously my head would still be in the exact same place and I'd make the exact same decision again. You know, maybe if we all had taken a break for 6 months, maybe I'd still be there now. Who knows? But that's just the way the cookie crumbled.
Was there never any talks of getting you back in then?
No. It was too long. You know, you have to remember, I was in Westlife for 6 years. They've been going for what? I left 20 years ago, 2004, so 20 years ago. So it's two different bands. The band that I was in is the one, you know, the 6 years I was there and the albums I did. They've had like 10, 11 albums or something since I've left. And it's two completely different bands. You know, like even I spoke to Nicky Byrne a few weeks ago and we were talking about it. I was like, even if I was to do something with the boys, how would that work? I don't sing any of the songs for the last 20 years. It'd be, yeah, I'd literally just be standing behind them.
Like the comeback of Brian.
But it wouldn't be. It's not like Oasis where they just go back and do the Oasis songs. I'd be doing a few songs from the first 6 years and then there'd be 11 albums of stuff that I've nothing to do with. You know, it would make no sense. It is two completely different bands.
Yeah.
And they see it the exact same as well.
Yeah, I think everyone thought you were going to, because remember they made the comeback, was it about 10 years ago? They done the Croker gigs.
Make that's a comeback, right,
they make a comeback, then you have a farewell and then they come back and farewell again. They just fucking
see you later tour.
I'm going this time tour, like, you know what I mean? But like Robbie came back to take that when they done that tours, you know what I mean? Even Ronaldo came back to United.
I know, yeah.
Brian couldn't come back to Westlife.
No,
No.
Oh, look how the Ronaldo worked out as well.
Yeah.
He just doing me, just leaves in the middle again.
Yeah. Keith, what I'm getting out of this is that it was cutthroat. From the theories, very similar stories, that it's cutthroat, rootless business.
At the very beginning, to get it right, what the, you know, if they're going to invest money in it, which for Boyzone, nobody invested money in it.
Yeah.
You know, we just had to graft it out. We were working for 30 quid a week. You know, I don't know, anybody in their sane mind would have just walked away. But we just loved the crack we had together. We enjoyed five lads.
You'd do it for nothing, though, wouldn't you?
Very we had great fun.
It was so much fun.
We were great. Yeah. It was like going away on holidays every weekend. Mm. You know, I mean, when we were growing up, we'd be lucky to go down to Wexford to a caravan for a couple of weeks. Mm. All of a sudden, I'm in the back of a van. And Louis used to say, no girls, no girlfriends. You're not little girlfriends. Because our audience wanted to know we're available and we're single, you know.
Yeah, but we
all had girlfriends, apart from Stephen, obviously. And we'd take the girls with us every weekend. You know, once Louis wasn't watching, I was saying that myself and Shane used to have to get the train from Hope Junction into Tara Street. And, you know, we'd be going in white dungarees and baseball caps on sideways. So we got battered on the way to the train station. so we got bullied. Our trainers, we'd have a nice pair of trainers on, you know, and they'd be robbed off us and we'd have to wear somebody else's scissors to get into town. And we'd go, and Louis, if you rang Louis's office, if you were a fan of Boyzone, you rang Louis's office and you said, where can I meet the boys? He'd say, they meet at the Royal Dublin in O'Connell Street at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever.
You tell everyone where you're going to be.
Yeah.
He tells everybody where you're going to be. So we'd get the train into Tara Street, myself and Shane. We walked down to the Royal Dublin. There'd be a gang of girls there waiting on us. And then this big limo would pull up to pick us up. Louis had said, you know, we're going off to Limelight in the Glenties and then down to Cork. Like, I mean, he used to throw darts at the map for the gigs at the weekend. And we'd get into the limo and we'd drive around to the ILAC centre and we'd get kicked out. We'd get into a white van.
And
we go. It was all perception, you know.
but you know what,
as well, the big thing for me is when I think back to the beginning of the bands, it was never about money, you know. You were talking there, Keith, about doing gigs for 30 quid a week. When I got into West, I've never, ever once thought about the fact, oh, I'm going to be rich. It was always, I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be successful. It was never about money.
Mm.
And now it's the complete opposite.
Yeah.
Now I do anything not to be famous and have loads of money.
Have a few bit. But what I was getting at there was, there would have been an overlap where, like, you as well, Louis's project, and then next fall, Westlife was coming along. Did you feel like, what's going on here?
Yeah, of course. We were touring Southeast Asia. We were in Bangkok and my dad rang me and he said to me, you better enjoy yourself, son. Your days are pretty much numbered.
Mm.
I says, what do you mean, Dad? He says, well, while you are over there, Louis Walsh is all over the television and the newspaper putting together a new boy band. And it was shocking to us at the time, but we kind of didn't believe it, you know. And then we thought, oh, well, maybe there's room for another band. And there wasn't too much panic. But then Louis was very clever.
Mm.
Louis gave Ronan 50% of the management of Westlife at the time. And that was to keep, because if Boyzone broke up, Louis had a new band to replace us and Ronan would probably be the one to go solo. So it meant he keeps Ronan as a solo artist because Ronan's involved in Westlife with them. They're already business partners. And those days, when you're selling, all our tours were sold out. All the arena tours were sold out all over the UK and Europe and stuff like that. So up and coming bands, the record company used to pay us huge money to get their band a slot as our support act. Because you're going on to a ready-made audience. And if you're half good, you're going to get traction. And Westlife went on our tour for free because Ronan was their manager. And that's how it was sold to us. We'd no choice. These boys are going on your stage. That was 98. We broke up 18 months later. We broke up in 99. So it was all very, very cleverly done and put together. And of course, Westlife had a ready-made audience. They were very talented. They were great singers. They got great songs. Their first song, Flying Without Wings, was it Swear It Again, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. But Flying Without Wings, their second song, to come back with such a great, great pop tune, which at the time was actually written for Stephen Gately. But it's a phenomenal song. And the guys' vocals, like Stephen and Ron were great singers, but the guys' vocals were a different character. You know, they're vocalists, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So they filled that void then, that basically...
Take that left, Boyzone filled the void. Boyzone left, Westlife filled the void. And that's just the way the world
then
works.
Then it was Blue.
Back in the 90s, you know, there was a serious amount of money made in album sales. CDs, albums, tapes, all that type of stuff. We only did concerts to sell the albums. Now, what we do... You make new music to sell bigger venues, to get more bums on seats. And there's nowhere near the amount of money in concert touring than there is selling albums.
Mm.
But that's all gone now, the stream. 90% of the revenue made in the music business in the 90s is gone.
Yeah.
The only way to make money now is live.
Gigs, that's it.
Gigs.
It's the only thing you can't download for free.
Yeah.
Ticket, you know.
And that's where you give people the experience on. That's what people want to go and see you for, isn't it?
Of course.
Because that gig is different to going to any other gig.
Yeah.
This is
but that's why we have to keep... you know, reinventing ourselves and bringing out new music. And this recent song, I Would, that we brought out, like, it's a cracking song. It's yes. You know, back in the day, I so badly wanted to release a credible song. You know, instead of standing on stage going, don't love me for fun, girl. Let me be that one, girl. You know,
you're still like, doing that.
The lads on the Gaelic football team are not going to think this is cool. You know what I mean? Yeah. I wanted to come out with some rock tunes. So, but the stuff that we do now, I really like the music. I'd buy it. I'm invested in it. So I enjoy what we do so much more now because I love the music. You know, we've written it, we've recorded it ourselves. It's our, we're in control of our own shit now, you know, so yeah. It's much better.
So we're kind of caught up now at this stage, would you say?
Well, kind of, how did you two come together then?
That's where I was going next.
Well, Westlife got that support act on the Boys on Tour in 1998.
Yeah, yeah.
And me and him were the two messers in the bands.
The two Ginnets.
Yeah, right.
So we always get on well. Over the years then, we meet up, we play golf in these charity events, and Brian went to live in Australia for years, and when Boys on were back together doing a tour, we'd be down in Australia, and I'd go out for a night out with Brian, and then I'd wake up on the sofa looking at the other four boys on TV, then I'm supposed to be there, but I missed it.
I'll never forget that. That's a true story.
Yeah.
Oh, I was over making a cup of coffee, and I looked at the TV, and I saw him asleep on the couch, and I looked, and there's the boys singing, and I was like, just wake up, he goes, are you supposed to be there? I was like, oh, bollocks.
So he came back. I was doing 6 months in the West End doing an Irish play called A Handful of Stars, a Billy Roach play, and it's a very scary space, you know. You're played to 50,000 people, and it's easy, it's what we do.
Yeah.
But when you're in a space like Trafalgar Studios in the West End of London, 8 shows a week,
yeah,
with the eyeballs on you, with a 12-page monologue, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
But it's what I love. It's my passion. And I just done 6 months, and I decided that I'd like to try and do it on my own as a one-man show. There was a one-man show called In High Germany, which was about the Irish football team, and an Irish guy wrote a one-man play about going to see Ireland in Germany in the European, back in the late 70s, I think it was. And that fell apart on me. So I thought, I'd like to write a play. I'd like to do a one-man show because I want to scare the shit out of myself, and that's how to do it, you know? So I didn't know where to start. How do you write a play? What's it going to be about? Who's going to, like, what's the character going to be? And I was out with Des Bishop one night, and I was telling Des, he goes, just write an autobiographical show, Keith. Write about your experiences over the last 25 years as an artist, as a singer. The people that you must have worked with, the stories backstage, there must be really interesting stories that everybody'd love to know the inside track to. You know, it's like off the top of your head, who would be Flash Guy that you performed with, you know? And then you start thinking and going, well, Pavarotti sent his private jet to Dublin to pick us up to fly to Modena to perform with him on stage. And, you know, and then we ended up singing with B.B. King and Joe Cocker and Mariah Carey and Gloria Estefan and the B.G.
We threw Ryanair to get Mariah Carey.
So I told stories. I was writing stories about what happened backstage, and I had a race with Joe Cocker in Italy one night when we were locked, and there was different stories that we came up with, and going through the airport drunk with Stephen Gately and falling asleep in the plane, and, you know, paying for first class and waking up after having 8 hours sitting on the jacks after falling asleep in the jacks of the plane. And there was some really funny stories, and we would sing the song that went with the story.
Yeah.
So this is what I was planning, and I'd met Brian on the golf course. We were playing in a charity golfing event over in Birmingham, and we were playing together, and I said what are you doing? He goes, he was only back from 8 years living in Australia, and he said, I'm playing Whelan's on Saturday night. Now, to go from a boy band to play such a renowned venue like Whelan's, that's pretty cool, you know. Mm. And I was quite impressed, going, that's cool, man, for all the shit we took for being in a boy band, and now you're up there with your guitar and your band, and you're doing all your own songs that have all just been number one. And today, actually 20 years ago, Real to Me was number one in 8 countries, his first solo song. So anyway, we went to Whelan's, myself, my son, and a few of our mates, and he blew the roof off the place, his first performance back in Ireland in years, and we were having a few points celebrating afterwards in the dressing room, and he said to me, what are you up to? And I says, well, I'm after writing this kind of one-man show where I'm going to do this, that, and the other. And he said, oh, that sounds deadly. I'd love to do something like that. And I'm kind of thinking, well, I don't really want to tour on my own, actually.
Yeah.
So why don't we rewrite it and you do it with me? So our first show together wasn't Boys Life as a singing group. It was the name of the show.
Yeah.
It was Keith and Brian, Boys Life, Stories, Laughter, and Music.
Yeah.
And it was like, you boys are sitting there on two armchairs. We were three-piece suits, a glass of wine, a little lamp. And we sold out in 4 hours. We sold out something like 38 shows in 4 hours.
Class.
3 shows in, we put on Stories, Laughter, Music Part 2, because there was loads more stories that we couldn't fit into the show. And that sold out. And then it organically grew to just doing concerts, because then the fans are going, you're only singing 6 songs in the show because you're telling all these stories. We'd love to hear more of the songs. You have over 20 UK number one songs between you.
Yeah.
Would you not sing more songs? So we went out on a tour just doing the songs. And we were playing small venues, academy venues and stuff like that. And they were only going okay. They weren't going, they didn't sell out. They sold maybe 60 to 80%. And we were a little bit deflated because we're used to playing to massive audiences. Yeah. And all of a sudden they were doing concerts and they're not selling. And this guy came into our dressing room one day in Birmingham and he said, guys, I want to put you out on the road with a full live band, because we were singing backing tracks at the time. He says, I want to put a full live band of girls behind you wearing little white or blonde bobbed wigs, five girls.
Yeah, we can do that.
I'm struggling to see the downside. and I said to the man, did you see the gig tonight? We're not even selling out. Like, I said, are you mad? Because he was giving us what's called a minimum guarantee.
Yeah.
So regardless whether we sold 3 tickets or 3,000 tickets, we were getting the same amount of money.
Yeah.
And it was a great deal. I said, look, man, I'll take your money off you. I said, but we don't know what's going on. He said, you're doing it all wrong. Your fans are of an age now where they want to be in a nice velvet comfy seat with catering and with drinks and a bar and not a sticky pub. You know, you need to go into proper venues, the real historically gorgeous theatre, city halls, town halls. Like Gaieties and the Olympia of the UK. So he put in a 38-day tour and he sold it out in a couple of days.
Class. Madness.
And it was amazing. And we haven't stopped since then. He'd done a second tour then and we were 5 nights into the tour. And COVID kicked in and stopped us. And then we were 2 years off the road and we wrote and recorded the studio album and put that out then, you know. And that's up to now. We're launching that. We didn't tour this year. Yeah. We've done all the festivals and we've done corporate gigs and we do private events. But next year, like I say, we're going on a whole world tour in America for the first time. I toured America with Boyzone, but it was all the hard rock cafes of America trying to break it in. But these are proper venues, proper gigs, and we're looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think when people hear this now, they'll understand more. And it's not just like, oh, two fellas who were big in the 90s and now they're just amalgamating together. They'll understand, oh, actually, there's a lot of thought behind this. It's not a cash grab.
Yeah. No, like, we love what we do, man.
Yeah. No, but like, it's nice to know that it came from a nice place of like, I want to tell a story. Brian's telling his story and that's where it came from, but actually grew. So it just happened to keep the same name, you know.
Well, I think the songwriting is what kind of made it grow for us as well, because you know after doing a couple of years of just singing the old songs, like songwriting was a massive part of my life. And when we started doing Boys Life, obviously that kind of halted for a while because we were just singing all the old stuff. And
yeah,
I just kept saying to Keith, I was like, we got to write some new music. I was like, I can't just keep singing the old stuff. I need to create new music. So when we got into the studio then and we wrote our first original album, that's when it all kind of changed. Then it had gone from us just performing our old stuff to this is new. You know, we're actually bringing out new music. We're creating something. And for me then, I was happy as a pig and shit then, because we were getting new songs and a new buzz. And yeah, I'm really happy where we are right now.
Yeah.
And Louis Walsh or Simon Cowell isn't involved anymore, boys, no?
No. We were gigging last night though and Louis came along. You have to understand him. He just rip you apart.
Yeah.
And I didn't mean it, lads. But you're shite. But I didn't mean it, you know. But we did a load of songs and we threw. And it was our first live performance of our new song. And our band are brilliant. You know, they're session players. They're the best musicians in the world. They're fantastic. And it was a great vibe. And we play all these big venues. But when you're on a stage that small with a live band and that, it just feels real. You know, it feels like it's a real band. It's not a boy band. It's two lead singers to a great backup band, you know.
Yeah.
And we done the big hits, but we also did our new song, you know. And Louis kind of came into the dressing room afterwards and we were kind of hyper. We were buzzing after coming off stage and your adrenaline does be flowing when you get off stage. You know, you can't wait for a beer and to have a few drinks and enjoy yourself. And Louis came and goes, yeah, good show, lads, very good. But Brian, you should just stick to the hits. We were going, our new song is brilliant. What are you talking about? No, stick to the hits, stick to the hits.
So rootless. Yeah. So you're working on a documentary, Brian, aren't you?
No, he is.
No, we've been working on a documentary for the 30th anniversary of Boyzone.
No, the Louis Theroux one.
Oh, he's on that one.
Oh, yeah, that was just, it was an hour long interview. It's Louis Theroux's making the show. He doesn't actually interview you. So I just basically told stories about being in Westlife. You know, he interviewed myself, Simon Cowell, Robbie Williams, and it's just basically all about boy bands, you know, the whole boy band era, the late early 90s and late 90s. And yeah, I haven't seen it yet, but I should be okay, I think.
Yeah,
and they're doing a documentary about Boyzone.
We've been shooting a documentary for the last couple of years about the whole start of Boyzone and Stephen and Sheriff Street, Donna Mead, and how we got together against all odds, the shit thing and the Late Late Show, and
how we
grew and you know, the trials and tribulations of the band. And the whole Stephen thing was a serious story, you know. When Stephen died, the country came out and supported him, and when he came out as being gay, and it was a horrible time for Steve, but the support he got was phenomenal. And they lined Sheriff Street with white roses when we were driving down you know, with Stephen to go in there. And we slept in the church the night before. And that was an experience in itself, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning being woke up by Daniel O'Donnell and Nigella to say, I just came in to say a prayer with you lads, you know. Like, you know, but it was an amazing thing. The support the country gave us, man, it was just, it was mind-blowing. We're in a church, St. Lawrence O'Toole's church there on Sheriff Street. And basically what happened was we went down to see Margaret, Stephen's mother, and just to sit with her for a while. And she was obviously heartbroken, beside herself, distraught. And they'd moved out of the family house. They'd moved into assisted care, living his dad and his mom. So they had no room to have the wake in the house and Stephen's remains. So, but Ronan and I had offered up our houses, but they wanted to stay in town. They didn't want to go out to our houses. And, you know, and they didn't want to leave Stephen in the church because he was afraid of the dark. And his mom said, we can't leave him there. He's afraid of the dark. And I said to her, well, look, we'll stay with him. We'll stay with him and he won't be on his own. And she goes, oh, would you do that? And we said, yeah. So myself and Ronan and Shane and Mikey, we stayed with Steve-O. And somebody put it out on the radio that we were sleeping the night before. So the sacristy's door gets a knock about 8 o'clock in the evening and I opened. And it was Army Bargains from Capel Street sent down for sleeping bags and 4 pillows, you know. And all these things were making us even worse, you know. And then there's a knock at the earlier in the evening, there was a knock at the door. And what's that chip shop?
Pizza,
Leo Burdock's. Burdock sent down loads of fish and chips to us, you know. And then there was some new bar in the IFSC, where all those new offices and all are. They sent over a box of beers and wines. And it was just the support was phenomenal. It was just amazing. So they're great stories, you know. And against the odds, we made it very, very, very big, you know, and the story is very interesting. So the documentary was supposed to be ready for the 30th anniversary, which was last year, but it's just been edited now. So there's 3 one-hour sessions coming out on Sky, I think in and around November or December.
Class.
Yeah. Brilliant. And what a blatant story, by the way. Class, that. Fucking hell.
Right. Yeah. Right, I think we're just about finished, lads.
Yeah, because your car parking is up, mate.
My car parking is up. Just one more thing. So you're going through all these dates. I want to go back to 2017, May, Brian, Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
ISIS.
What is it?
I knew this was coming up.
You put up a tweet, Brian, and it's absolutely iconic.
What is it? I've done a lot of tweets.
Calling out ISIS for a straightener. One-on-one.
He doesn't even remember this.
I just said, wouldn't it be better instead of blowing up kids with their bombs that they'd actually just fight people straight up? But yeah, they're wankers anyway, so fuck them.
Yeah. I doubt they're going to be going on your tour anyway. They're not going to buy tickets. So you said tour, lads. Do you want to plug a few dates?
Well, we're in the Olympia in Dublin in January, and all the tickets are on Ticketmaster. We're only doing 4 shows. We're doing one in Dublin, one night only, one in Dublin, one in Cork, one in Galway.
We were supposed to play Crow Park, but fucking Oasis took all the dates on
itself. Yeah,
Olympians, Dev.
And Crow Park in January is very cold.
Oh, too cold, yeah.
If we played Crow Park, you'd hear us singing 5 times with the fucking echo going around the bleeding room. So, come and see us in January. It's a great bit of crack.
Right, brilliant. That's
thanks,
it, boys.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming in, boys. We know my parking's up and Brian's flight is coming as well.
Yeah, I'm going to bed.
Yeah. And just before we wrap up, lads, again, shout out to FlyFit who are supporting the podcast for the last few months. Go on to flyfit.ie, get your membership and smash up fitness goals. Right, take us out there, Siobhan.
Bill.
Go Loud presents Talking Bollocks, proudly supported by FlyFit. With 20 locations nationwide, there's always a FlyFit gym nearby to help you crush your fitness goals. Visit flyfit.ie. Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.
What you waiting for? Put your back in it. Just a little more. Throw your whip in it now. Fill your body up. Walk it hard and slow. When you feel it done.
The hip knocker.
Go down.